From 2820 Radio in Philadelphia, it's The Build. Conversations with entrepreneurs and innovators about their dreams, their triumphs, and their challenges.
Sustainable. It's a word we hear a lot these days, but what's it really mean to run a sustainable business? And if you want to support a sustainable business, how would you even know where to look? That's a frustrating pair of questions that Morgan Berman's trying to solve. With the team at her startup venture, Morgan's cataloging products and services that can help city dwellers maintain their busy lifestyles without sacrificing their values. She's picked up plenty of accolades along the way from places like the Forbes 30 Under 30 list and the UN Foundation. And as she navigates both the crowdfunding and the venture capital worlds, she's discovering just what it takes to build a sustainable company of her own. It's the story of My Milk Crate, coming up next on The Build.
The Build is made possible with support from 2820 Press, providing business consulting and content strategy services to customer-obsessed companies nationwide. More information at 2820press.com.
It's The Build. I'm Joe Taylor Jr., joined today by Morgan Berman, founder of My Milk Crate. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
It's so great to be here. For folks who've been listening to the show, this is the first episode that we've actually done in our new studio. So we're learning all the interesting little sounds that the room makes. And Morgan is our neighbor two doors down. So this might be the shortest anyone's ever had to travel to come be on the show. So we're glad you made the journey.
Thank you. Yes, it was not arduous.
So we love to collect origin stories on the show. So tell me a little bit about how My Milk Crate got started.
Well, it depends how far back you want to go. We could go all the way back to before I was born. My mother was actually part of the farm-to-table renaissance in the city of Philadelphia. She was one of the first female chefs in Philly. So the concept of eating locally and healthfully and sustainably was kind of with me before I even existed. And when I was a child, she actually wrote books rating and reviewing thrift shops. So I was being taken on trips to go thrift shopping and learning about the value of money and also the value of reducing waste by not having to consume new products. And the kind of creative opportunity of taking something old and remaking it into something new. I actually started my first business when I was 16 with my mother, taking old vintage purses and remaking them into new one-of-a-kind kind of couture works of art, and Anthropology and Joan Shep actually bought some of those bags. So I had a taste of freakishly early success, and then I got bored and stopped doing it. Of course, I probably would be retired by now if I'd kept doing it, but I was a silly little 17-year-old. And then my mom, when she was a chef, actually back in the day, worked briefly with Judy Wicks and was a part of that scene. And when I was living in West Philadelphia as an adult, I started learning about what that meant, that Judy Wicks was like this movement, really. She was more than a person. She'd really created a buy local, eat local movement across the whole country. And I was reading about her and new urbanism, and I was really captivated by these values that really rang true with my upbringing and the possibility to use design to make a better city. This is my city. I was born and raised in Philly, and I wanted to contribute to it in a really tangible way. And my background in women's reproductive health, while rewarding, wasn't creative enough. I wasn't getting to do design, which was something I really missed. So I applied to grad school to get a master's in sustainable design at Philadelphia University. And I was lucky enough to be awarded an assistantship, which meant I got to work part-time and basically earn my degree without having to pay for it. And I was assigned to the head of our department, Rob Fleming, which was really lucky because he wound up getting to connect me to a lot of sustainability leaders in the city. And when it came time to do my master's thesis, I had worked for about a year at a local publication that focuses on sustainability. And I saw a lot of the promise and enthusiasm that a publication and covering the topic of sustainability and urban living had, but I also saw a lot of the shortcomings. And having worked at Apple part-time for about a year while doing research at Penn, I really was thinking a lot about mobile technology and how mobile technology was solving everyday consumer issues. I had people coming to me all day, every day out on the main line, you know, being like, I don't know how to do this. I want to find that. And it was my job to figure out what was the tech solution, if there was one. So kind of seeing the promise and pitfalls of print, I was like, you know, I think that there's a way to help people embrace the values and the lifestyle that I'd become really infatuated with in West Philly about eating locally and shopping locally and living sustainably. Maybe that could be my master's thesis. So when I was in grad school, I basically designed the first version of the app, put together a business model, and started building all of the relationships that I would need to get this thing off the ground. And because it was well received and people were wanting to help, it started turning into what I didn't realize at the time is called a tech startup. And my earliest teammates started, you know, they reached out and said, I want to be a part of this. And I was like, okay, sure. And eventually we brought on Jason, who's my co-founder and CTO, who built the first version of the app, which we launched August 2014. So it's about a year and a half now, which is amazing. So the app's been live for a year and a half. We're about to launch version 2.2.4 on Monday. And next week, we're actually going to be doing our strategy session for 2016 and version 3, which is going to be a really big update. And I'm really excited about what we've got planned.
So walk us through how the app actually works.
Sure. So right now, the best description that I've seen a reporter use is a green Yelp with soul. It's a directory tool that helps you find local sustainable businesses. So whether that's a fair trade coffee shop or a farm to table restaurant for lunch or a place to go buy something, whether it's clothing or for your house that's locally made, responsibly made, fair trade, you know, those kinds of values and qualifiers, those are the companies that are in our app. We also have a calendar of events that are all local sustainability related events. So the Clean Air Council's Green Fest or the Franklin Flea, which is local makers, often a lot of vintage, dine out for the environment. These are the kind of events that you can find in our calendar. And then we also, the third kind of thing that you can do in the app right now is actually take action. You can sign up to do something, whether it's signing up for bike share here in Philly called Indigo, or composting service, or a CSA. Philly Food Works has been running a CSA sign up in our app that's been really successful. So you can actually get your like local groceries delivered to you. So we try and make it easy for people to kind of stumble upon better ways of living that will make them feel good about how they're spending their money. Yeah. So those are the three things that you can currently do in the app.
I love that you brought up Judy Wicks. For folks who are listening outside of Philadelphia, Judy created a really foundational experience in West Philadelphia called the White Dog Cafe. And one of the things I always admired about what she had done there was it was this intersection of this the idea of farm to table and sustainable eating, but also Judy was a fantastic, still is really, but she's kind of semi-retired now, fantastic business person, because White Dog was outrageously successful for, you know, its time. And actually Judy managed to cultivate this bench of talent that spun out other types of businesses as well, Metropolitan Bakery and a bunch of folks that came up under her and just went out and started their own thing. And so now we have a lot of businesses that kind of look at White Dog as their roots, but you wouldn't know it if you just came to Philadelphia today. You just think that all these businesses just have already existed. One thing I'd love to touch on here is, how is it for you as the co-founder of a technology startup to reconcile the idea of social impact against making money?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the word I would challenge is against. I think what Judy proved is that it actually can facilitate, that doing the right thing can actually lead to success and even greater success financially, because people are drawn to things that reflect their values. They want to share who they are with the world, and they want to kind of internally reaffirm who they think they are. And if you're someone who thinks that you care about other people and your community and the planet, which a lot of people do, then you're drawn to spending your money at places like that. So, you know, it can sound like a superficial thing to be like, it's good marketing, but good marketing means you're resonating with people. And that's really powerful and not superficial, especially if you're doing it for good reasons.
So one of the other things that I wanted to touch on was, you spent a good amount of time in the nonprofit sector. What are some of the things that you have observed that for-profit organizations are adopting from that nonprofit world?
Right. Well, I think it ties into what I just said about the connection between profit and purpose, that those two things can be linked. And I think that that's, you know, the nonprofit world has kind of had a monopoly on purpose for a very long time, and the for-profit world has had a corner on the market of generating income. And what I think has really started to change in the last, it's been a decades long process, but bringing those two things together, I don't know if it would be a perfect future if they were one and the same, but that's kind of where it seems to be heading. There's this organization that actually was the very first B Corp in the world called the Untorse Foundation. And that's out in the suburbs of Philadelphia. They actually were the very first organization to be for-profit, taking their profits and investing them purely in social good efforts. And they actually are one of our funders now. And they've been funding other companies that are in our app, like Wash Cycle Laundry, which is another perfect example of a purpose-driven for-profit entity that is making our city a better place. So that whole story, just like the Judy Wicks story, the Untors story is also a Philadelphia one. So I think Philly is kind of driving that merging of the nonprofit and for-profit world. And actually something fun, another kind of coincidence or not, is that Philly has a ridiculously high number of nonprofits for a city. It's been one of the reasons it's been a great place for us to launch here is because we have so many data partners in those nonprofits. The way that we generate all the listings in our app is by partnering with organizations like B Corp and the Sustainable Business Network and Fair Food to bring all of their certified, accredited, whatever word that they use, we bring their businesses into our app. And then we put the badge of that nonprofit on that business. So having that nonprofit base and then those kind of social entrepreneur types like Jay Cohen Gilbert, the founder of B Corp, those have all, and Judy Wicks, those have been some powerful ingredients to make everything that's happening possible, including my milk crate.
We've had a few guests on the show this season talk to us about the idea of B corporations. Until that came along, I don't think we had the language or at least even the legal structure to talk about a for-profit entity that's tasked in its charter with actually doing social good. Typically, a corporation exists for the benefit of shareholders. The idea, and so we go back to Apple, for instance. So, journalistic disclosure.
Always back to Apple.
I think I was your boss for like hot second,
yep.
Right?
Yeah.
And this was about 4 or 5 years ago when we were both working in Apple. And the thing at the time was, Apple came under a lot of heat because Apple had no community investment or charitable giving plans at all. And Steve Jobs had pretty famously gone on the record and said, my job is to make the maximum money for shareholders. And it's up for shareholders to decide how they want to invest in social good. That's changed and softened a little bit. Tell me a little bit about how the journey has been for you to going, over the course of 5 years, to actually grow into this new leadership role. You've got a crew of folks that are populating the office down the way. You've got a posse now. So what's it been like to actually grow into not just a manager of people, but a leader?
Yeah. I'm going to answer that. And then I want to remind myself to look up. I think there's actually a really great quote about how Apple, and I think Steve Jobs, talked about the importance of taking their profits and investing them responsibly. And I want to find that quote. So remind me to do that. Cause I want to defend Steve.
Oh yeah. And to be fair, a lot of the things that Apple did were and things that we even did on our team. So thinking back, we were in a slice of Apple retail back when it was a very fairly flat organization. And one of the things that I was very proud of our team is that A, we were tasked with solving whatever problems that folks walked in the door with. So whether you're the owner of the Philadelphia Eagles or you have just started up a cupcake truck, it was our job to just figure out what's the right solution for you. Most of the time that involved actually helping people spend less money, which in any than they intended to spend, which in any business is usually not the way that you try to go. But the bigger thing was that within that, we would carve out budget to do things that you would never do in a typical organization because Apple could get away with it. There was a lot of leeway down to the whims of individual leaders, you know. So we're probably outside of NDA expiration periods about this, but Apple played a role in helping PhillyCam get off the ground because we unloaded some equipment at about a dollar above cost out the back door to be able to help Gretchen, you know, clear her budget. There were some other things that basically, as long as you got buy-in from your immediate supervisor, and at the end of the day, if you were just showing a profit, you could kind of do whatever you wanted, right? I don't think that it's the same now that there's a hardcore operations person in charge. But the idea here is that you can structure a business in a way to know that you are actually diverting what would otherwise be pure profit into impact. So let's pull that back and think about funding, right? Because right now, how does My Milk Crate actually generate revenue?
Yeah, we generate a small amount of revenue right now. It has not been the focus of our company. We're in that way kind of more of a West Coast tech startup. However, that is starting to shift. But for the first year and a half, we were really just funded by investors. We have a lot of really wonderful, mostly local investors, including Ben Franklin Technology Partners and Investor Circle. And as a part of the Ben Franklin money, we also have money through the Alliance of Women Entrepreneurs Fund, which is specifically money for women. So all of the money we've brought on at this point has pretty much been, at least the institutional money, impact money, meaning like socially good funding, and or because we're a woman-founded company, which is, you know, kind of a social good mission in the tech world. And we've been kind of operating off of the investment money, but we have generated revenue through the premium accounts that we sell to business owners. So business owners like Mugshots and Zipcar and Ticket Leap, Full and Happy Catering, these kinds of companies, they're all in the app. They were there, you know, they don't get special treatment, but in terms of passing our criteria. But then once, if they want to take the next step to have a custom profile and to stand out in the app in terms of search results and things like that, then they pay an annual subscription fee for that. And so we've generated revenue from those sales as well as the take action campaigns. So Philly Food Works being able to sign up for their CSA, the energy co-op, those are companies, you know, bought the opportunity to reach our users and generate leads through our app's users.
So I've heard you mention Yelp as an analogy, you know, a similar service. The business model sounds quite similar to Yelp. How do you defend My Milk Crate from just being perceived as a feature of some larger, more entrenched competitor?
Well, exactly. Right now, it very much looks like that. But what we're becoming is actually going to be a guided lifestyle experience. We're going to be allowing our users to tell us about their habits, their interests, their lifestyle, and create a custom experience that guides them to becoming a better conscientious consumer. I've been calling it like a Fitbit for your wallet. So you'll actually be able to see your impact as a conscientious consumer and how well you're doing at living your values. And so that's what's coming this year. So the directory tool and the Yelp kind of thing is like the backbone, because we needed that database of those businesses and the events and all of that to be able to then do what's coming next. So it's very much a phase one, but the vision and what the user experience is going to be like, that's only going to be a significant fraction of it. The actual experience is going to be finding what you need, learning about something that interests you, and then actually progressing along a guided path and seeing yourself grow, and then eventually seeing your whole community grow as a group. So it'll have a very social feel as well.
So I want to go back to the idea of pitching investors, because I'm having a vision of you pitching to somebody like Roseanne at Ben Franklin yeah. Technology Partners. Tell me what the experience is to pitch in front of folks like that who really want lots of detail, lots of specific information. How did you get ready for that, and what was that experience like?
Well, it's funny you ask. So like I said, we launched the first version of the app in August 2014. And in October of 2014, well, actually in September of 2014, I found out that we had been selected as one of the five companies from across the country to pitch on stage at Forbes 30 Under 30 to Steve Case. So that was my first investor pitch.
No pressure.
So 2 months after launching the first, and I have to admit, rather, well, we're in Philly, janky version of our app, I was pitching in front of 2,000 of the most successful and well-respected tech people in the world. So everything after that's been kind of a cakewalk, honestly. I don't really get nervous. It was kind of baptism by fire kind of thing. And ever since then, it's whatever. Not to say that I don't have all the respect in the world for every other investor I've met, but nothing is as scary as that. And so it's been easier for me to just kind of sit down and be myself and be honest. And I think that that's really been part of our success with these investors, is that they can feel comfortable with me and trust me, and we can have more of a dialogue instead of this kind of like me trying to jam a business plan down their throat. And I think that that is important because everything always changes. And that's something I've really had to learn, is that even from week to week, our business model, our product, our team can change pretty dramatically. And what investors are looking for and what a successful company needs to be is adapt. And it's about the people, and it's about thinking behind how you implement. And that's really what matters most. And so that stage was a pretty contrived experience, and it was terrifying. And so ever since then, it's been easier to just have a more natural one, I guess.
Now, you've had a little experience with crowdfunding as well.
Yeah.
So tell us about that experience.
So we launched a crowdfunding campaign when we launched the app in 2014, and we did it on Indiegogo. And what I did was I went around to local business owners that were in the app, or were going to be in the app because the app wasn't live yet. And I said, we're creating this experience for people to help consumers find businesses like yours. Our mission is to help you make more money. Could you help us get off the ground? And so they donated products and services for us to sell in our crowdfunding campaign. Most like wildly successful crowdfunding campaigns, they have a gadget that's super cool that people want, and they can pre-order it. That's like a successful, that's what you should do for crowdfunding. We didn't have that. We were selling a free downloadable app. So in order to have something that people would be willing to pay for, we had to rely on these business owners, and they came through. You know, the first one or two, it was like a little bit of a hard sell, but once we got one or two, then everyone else was like, oh, well, if they're doing it, yeah, I'll totally do it. And then we got probably 24 businesses on board. And so we were able to generate, we hit 103% of our goal. Connor Barwin actually came in at the last minute and put us over the limit, which was phenomenal. We are forever thankful to him for that. He did a little video with us that we've also used in our crowdfunding campaign. Yeah, it was the most stressful probably experience I've had to date with running this company. It is not something to be done lightly, but it really helped us kind of get the word out there and get the first funding in.
So as CEO today, where do you like to spend your time, and what do you wish you were spending more time on?
Right now, I really see my job as, in an ideal world, it would be, I don't know if I mean ideal. I think it's supposed to be I'm fundraising all the time. In an ideal world, I wouldn't have to do that at all, and I would dedicate myself 50-50 to product. And luckily, I've brought someone on who's better at kind of organizational infrastructure and accountability. She's our newest teammate. And so she's going to be taking over what would probably be in a tech startup, the CEO's job, but she's more of like a COO. And what I love doing and what I'm best at is kind of daydreaming about what we could accomplish and finding those partnerships. So when I'm at my best, I'm doing things like building the new relationship we have with Lyft, or meeting with the DNC host committee yesterday. Those are the kind of like seeing opportunities for overlap and mutual benefit, and like building that relationship and kind of figuring out where we can be of service to these really fantastic opportunities for us. So that's what I'm best at and what I love doing. And I also just love doing the kind of rough design work for the app, what the user experience is going to be like, and thinking about our brand and how people kind of visually interact with us. I'm a very visual person. I love doing design. So those are the things that I'm best at and would love to do more of. And I'm starting to, but I've also been doing a lot of fundraising and, you know, negotiating with lawyers and figuring out what all these documents mean, finding a new office, setting up the office, hiring, firing, you know, things that are not as much fun and can be scary and new, but are necessary.
What's the hardest decision you think you've had to make as CEO?
You know, it's weird because a lot of the decisions I've made, it hasn't felt like it was made in one moment. It was like a snowball. Like the hardest things that I've dealt with, it hasn't been like I've, you know, I was handed a button that said yes and a button that said no and I had to tap one. It hasn't really been like that. There have been so many. It's all hard. Almost all of it. God, what do other people say?
Most folks usually think about either the product or the team.
Yeah. I mean, like when I think about the team, there's definitely like there have been four people that have left, and that has been hard, whether it was because I was asking them to leave or I was helping them realize that they should decide to leave. Though that's been gut wrenching and I haven't regretted any of it, thankfully. But again, like I said, it's been a snowball. I haven't made any quick decisions.
It doesn't make it any easier.
Yeah. No. Another hard decision was just where to move our office. Cause my team will tell you, I dream big and I want, when I have that vision of what we're going to become in a few years, I want it now. And one of the things was I really want a storefront. It's not a normal thing for a tech startup to want, but maybe it's because of my Apple roots. I want a storefront that looks like a comfortable neighborhood coffee shop where people come in and we have like a representative that's there to just like hang out with people and talk to them about sustainability, teach them about the app, show them about other businesses in the neighborhood, like a kind of Apple-like experience where you can just come in and schmooze and learn. And that we have our offices in the back. And then like on Friday nights, we have like an open house with drinks and like schmoozing and talking to neighbors. Maybe one week it's just for business owners and then other weeks it's for like nonprofit partners. Like have a really community interactive space that's also a really great, you know, marketing tool. And I was like, we're doing that now. That's where we're moving. And they were like, the budget and time and you're crazy. And so I was traveling for work. I was out on the West Coast in four different cities in like 10 days, meeting with investors and Lyft and Eventbrite and like building relationships with Facebook. It was awesome. It was like East Coast tech entrepreneur wonderland. And they were off looking at offices and sending me pictures and FaceTiming with me. And they were like, I was slowly having to come down from my cloud of like, it's going to happen. We're doing this. And they're like, Morgan, this place has like holes in the wall and it's $2,000 a month and like the lights don't work. And, you know, it was just like clearly not going to happen right now. And we were really like, everyone said, Morgan, I really think Ben's desk is going to be the best option. I know that you didn't want to share the space, but once I came and I saw it, I was like, okay, I can put the dream on pause. This will be a very good intermediary. But that was scary and hard for me because like I get so excited when I finally have like this, you know, crazy entrepreneur vision of what's going to happen and I have to like hit the pause button. But I'm glad we did. And now when I come into the office, you know, I get to kind of, there's this little like twinkle in my eye when I look around and I'm like, this is ours. You know, that's really special. And it's made something that is very intangible, like our company in many ways. It's just kind of, it's like this froth of nothing that somehow eventually becomes something tangible and permanent and solid. And this is one of those like little moments that's kind of solidifying the froth of a tech startup.
We'll have to put some links in the show notes because we're both in the same shared collaborative workspace. Benjamin's Desk is a client of our agency as well. We've worked on a lot of their marketing and messaging. But Anthony Mayer, who's the CEO there, is a fun, quirky guy, former pro soccer player, but he and his brother are very into design. And what we've done in this new space, which is pretty interesting, is we've got this very eclectic shared space right outside our studio here. You've got this gorgeous tricycle that you brought in. And then we found these inherited kind of Edison lights that have been strung out like it's kind of a carnival festival thing. And we said, this is really kind of neat festive atmosphere. And then we found all these old trophies from the advertising agency that used to be here and set them out on this fireplace. So we've got this kind of weird, quirky, fun space here. Mm-hmm. So before we wrap up, though, I do want to talk to you about what your dream is for My Milk Crate. Where does it go? Over the next 5 years?
I want it to become a tool that diehard sustainability geeks like myself are drawn to and can benefit from. But in addition to that, I want it to be something that pretty much anyone can kind of fall into and feel like they can make it their own. And that at the end of the day, we actually will be able to conclude whether or not Mayor Michael Nutter, now former Mayor Michael Nutter, was right when he said he was going to make Philly the most sustainable city in the country. We want to actually be able to have the data that proves whether or not we are.
Thanks to Morgan Berman for joining us today. You can learn more about My Milk Crate at mymilkcrate.co or from the show notes posted at thebuild.biz. The Build is a production of 2820 Radio in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Our producer is Lori Taylor. Our associate producer is Katie Cohen-Zonizer. Our talent coordinators are Katrina Smith and Gazem Yali. And our post-production team is led by Evan Wilder at Flowly Audio in Detroit. My name is Joe Taylor Jr. Thanks for listening to The Build.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Build. We hope you'll share this series with your friends and provide us with feedback on the iTunes Store. You can also subscribe to weekly updates and learn more about upcoming guests by visiting our show page at thebuild.biz. This has been a 2820 radio production.